So truckers are exempt from fair labor standards. They don't get the kinds of protections that other folks get. So instead of dealing with it that way, what we do is we do this band-aid where we like sometimes shock a driver like back into alertness when his eyelids start to flutter. That's like a really interesting choice that we've made, I think, to use technology in this kind of band-aid-y way. So we live and learn while wisely guided not to fear what's yet to be decided. So
hi, everyone. Welcome to the Received Wisdom podcast. I'm Shobhita Parthasarathy.
And I'm Jack Stilgo. So, Shobhita, first things first, you were award-winning. You got an award from your university. Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
The world is waking up to your brilliance. You also got a big chunk of money, which is quite interesting, from the Ford Foundation. Can you just tell us a bit about what you want that money to do for your department at Michigan and why it matters?
Yeah, sure, Jack. Thanks. I started this program in science and technology policy 15 years ago when I was a wee assistant professor. We have been trying to grow, our Michigan program has been trying to grow for a while, and I'll spare you all of the details, but the exciting thing is that the Tech and Society program at the Ford Foundation, they tend to fund a lot of advocacy groups in the tech, justice, and equity space, a handful of scholars, I think in part because of our focus on equity and justice issues, and they are giving us core funding, which is so rare. But what they're particularly interested in is helping us build our partnerships work. And what we've been saying is we really want to center communities in discussions about science and technology. And by that, I don't just mean community activists. I mean communities who are not already organized and advocating, but people who are affected by science and technology, who are enrolled in it, whether they want to be or not, and often have no voice whatsoever. And so our hope is to start from communities and engage with them about what they want and need, what their knowledge is and priorities, and have them drive the conversation about what kinds of science and technology and policy they want to see, and then link them with technical experts and STS folks and policy folks, et cetera.
And I think people who aren't in universities maybe aren't aware of quite how unusual that way of doing things is. Because people in universities, the sort of dominant way in which they think about engaging with the world is, oh, we know stuff and we've got stuff to tell you. Sit down and listen to our stuff. And that's how they think about community engagement. The idea that local communities, particular interest groups, have things to teach us is something that it's very hard to persuade senior people in universities of.
Absolutely. I mean, I had a response last night from a colleague who was like, oh, it's really great that you're doing this community work. I think that the most important thing is that communities tend to engage in these technical debates and don't understand anything about them. And so perhaps we can teach them about the science so they can become better activists. And while I don't want to reject that out of hand, because you have now housing activists and food justice advocates who are being confronted with algorithmic governance, and they do need to get to know the technologies and their power better. And so there's a role for technical expertise. But first of all, it's a knee-jerk reaction, right? It's, God, how could communities possibly have anything to tell me? I have lots of degrees and I understand the technology.
Or rather, they might have something to tell me, but only once I've told them the facts of the matter first.
That's right. I will set the terms of the debate and no kind of reflection about that. But I think that that is due to power position. You know, in my experience teaching graduate students, it's not necessarily coming from a place of explicit hubris. It's just that they've never had to think about it in a complicated way before. They've never been challenged. And often my students, once you ask them questions enough, they're like, wait a second, why do we think this way? I mean, sure, we have some expertise. We don't have other kinds of expertise. And I mean, the other part of this that I also find really weird is just because you have an expertise in X, what exactly is it that you're going to teach these community members? I mean, you don't actually have the kind of general expansive technical knowledge anymore as a full professor and whatever. You know one tiny niche of the world at a level of technicality that is not actually useful.
Well, I think that's the other sort of dirty secret, right, about universities' lack of desire to get involved in community engagement is that in engaging with people who think about things differently from how you think about things, you will realize the limits of your knowledge as well, or the lack of applicability of your knowledge.
Yes. If you are actually open, though, I mean, that's the key. I think for a lot of people, they're not necessarily ready for that conversation.
Yeah, but either way, you know, it has the potential to be a very uncomfortable set of conversations.
Yeah, that is very true.
Anyway, congratulations. Keep changing the world.
Well, thank you. A lot of work ahead, but it is such a milestone. So there has been so much going on in our world of science and technology policies.
No shortage of news.
No shortage of news since our last episode. Perhaps the biggest headline-grabbing thing has been the Facebook files.
Yeah, let's talk about the Facebook files.
Yeah. What has this response been like in the UK?
You know, the UK tends to, especially the UK media, tends to have a very parochial approach about these things, which often means that the stories about Facebook get reduced to stories about Nick Clegg, our former Deputy Prime Minister, who then became Facebook's head of PR, mm-hmm. at a time at which becoming Facebook's head of PR looked like quite an easy gig. It's like, woo, yeah, I used to be a politician. Why not move to Silicon Valley? It's nice and sunny there. I can just take off my tie, put on a hoodie and put my feet up. And then Facebook has been systematically shooting itself in the face ever since. So we can't have that much sympathy for Nick Clegg. But before Facebook changed its name to Meta in a hope to change the narrative surrounding its rather toxic products, we should remember that a whistleblower, Francis Haugen, came forward and said, in effect, you know, Facebook knows all sorts of stuff about how bad its products are, how bad they are for the circulation of information, how bad they are for teenagers' mental health, and it's covering it up. The suggestion being, in effect, that Facebook is basically like tobacco. One of her accusations that should have been quite damaging was that Facebook knew about the harms that they were causing, but in effect, they didn't care about them because they were more interested in profit, to which we might say, well, they're a company. Unless lawmakers tell them to be interested in something else, they will be interested in profit. And Mark Zuckerberg's response was so interesting. He said, oh, no, don't. You're being so mean. I wouldn't possibly ever harm anybody on purpose. And in effect, he's sort of using claims of technological neutrality as his excuse, which is sort of what we would expect from Facebook. It's not like, oh yeah, we're going out there and being baddies because we're bad people. It's like, all we want is for people just to share their stuff. And all we're doing is maximizing engagement. And if bad people use that to spread bad things and do bad stuff, then that's not our problem. And I think that argument is starting to fall apart in the eyes of policymakers. Maybe that's me being optimistic. I mean, what's your sense, especially of how it went down in Congress?
I'm still trying to figure out whether this is the moment that things might shift. There have been a lot of hearings where Haugen was front and center. There's been an enormous amount of reporting. The thing that seems to have really caught people's attention is the impact of Facebook on kids and particularly young teenagers and body image and eating disorders, which is so interesting, the framing that catches in the United States. There have been also a lot of calls to break up Facebook, but I think that people are still really struggling to figure out how it might be regulated. We are really struggling to grapple with what Facebook is. And because we can't quite figure out what Facebook is, we can't figure out whether and how it should be regulated. Is Facebook a media company? Is it a tech company? Is it operating in the public interest? Is it a private company? Of course, everything turns into a partisan fight. So it's all laid on this question of which party Facebook is hurting more or less. It's also strange that we would expect a company that is self-regulating to be acting in a benevolent fashion. I mean, obviously that's not the case.
And we sort of buy into this idea that the mode of governance should be one in which we sort of wait for Mark Zuckerberg himself to realize that issues are important. And it's notable that for all of the hearings and all of the fines that Facebook have sort of coughed up, which they are happy to regard as the price of doing business, there's been no actual legislation. So the performative thing in which lawmakers get round and say, oh, maybe this time we'll persuade Mark to be nicer, right? And that being the mode of regulation just seems so balmy.
I mean, what's interesting to me is that in the US context, it goes back to a frontier mentality, right? And God forbid we would regulate Zuckerberg or Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. But it is interesting to me that they have not faced consequences anywhere else in the world that isn't so tied to those kinds of frontier fictions.
While we're fixating on the sort of US and UK things, Facebook is having a massive impact in parts of the world where, you know, they don't have the same capacity to govern.
I do not think that it has gotten nearly enough attention. If the problem keeps getting replicated in the coverage of the Facebook files, there's massive problems both with misinformation and fomenting, you know, in Myanmar, the coup, and in India, misinformation. In these countries, Facebook or one of its subsidiary companies is a primary mode of communication, and therefore it becomes a central place for all of the ugliest parts of society. And yet, the company has decided not to invest in content moderation or anything at any kind of scale to address the problem, in part perhaps because they realize nobody cares in the West. Any of the countries that are in the best position to regulate them don't care, so why would we spend money? But it's having this enormous effect. But then Frances Haugen actually reproduces this problem because the consortium of media outlets that she chose to provide the Facebook files to does not include any media outlets from lower middle income countries, which is unbelievable to me. You know, it's all just a self-fulfilling thing because now very little coverage, as far as I know, in the Western countries about what is happening in Southern countries, even though they've done enormous damage. So then that doesn't become part of the frame that motivates any discussion, even though supposedly we care.
Yeah. And it looks like this is yet another massive existential crisis for Facebook that has blown over and the company has got away with it. Because, as you say, we would rather have swashbuckling innovators. One other thing I wanted to ask you about. The US proposal recently for an AI Bill of Rights, which can be read in a few ways. Is this just the US sort of catching up to Europe's GDPR and saying, oh yeah, we should probably do something a lot like that as a sort of way to standardize the way that data is collected and used and repurposed? Or is there something else going on? Is this distinctly US?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because in our last episode, we talked about the UK's AI strategy and we talked a little bit about how the US has been managing it. The first I should note is that we've discussed on the podcast that the Federal Trade Commission is now being headed by Lina Khan, who is this extraordinary legal scholar who has been talking about regulating these platform companies and breaking up big tech.
I mean, we were definitely talking about her before she was cool.
That's right, exactly.
We're like an X factor for science technology policy.
Basically, yes. And they are also hiring Meredith Whitaker, who is an ex-Googler.
And not just an ex-Googler as well, but, you know, has been involved in worker organizing at Google and was seen as an extremely inconvenient voice for companies and for the world of tech.
Absolutely. And so there are very interesting things happening at the Federal Trade Commission. And I think that tends to be how policy works in the US, is that it's often on the regulatory side, they're able to maybe make incremental moves because we can't do big things. And so in that kind of line, there are a couple of other small things that could potentially have real impact that are interesting. So one, as you mentioned, is this AI Bill of Rights. So the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, which is not a regulatory agency, they're asking for broad public comment. And You know, I'm interested in this for a couple of reasons. I think it's a really cool idea and I'm curious what will happen with it. But I also think that it's interesting to think about what makes it a uniquely American phenomenon. I mean, it's called an AI Bill of Rights, for goodness sake. But also, when we talk about AI and we talk about how structural inequality shapes the kinds of data, for example, that are used in algorithms, or we talk about the data that's collected and whether or not it's extracted in appropriate ways and what happens to it, those aren't individual rights issues. Those are about social structure, they're about equity, justice, things that the Biden administration cares a lot about. And so I worry a little bit about, while framing something in terms of a Bill of Rights makes good political sense in this country, it also pulls off the table other issues. It perpetuates the idea that the relationship is between the individual and the technology instead of society shaping technologies and technology shaping society.
And it takes you to some sort of perverse models of governance, which we've all experienced firsthand. So when GDPR came in Europe, everybody in Europe got used to ticking and clicking boxes to say, yes, I accept cookies. But that's the sort of real-time manifestation of that model of government in which we presume that it is our right to inform ourselves about our rights and then make decisions based on those rights. And we all know, because nobody ever reads the terms and conditions. Doesn't work.
Exactly. There's no escaping that. Thanks to the EU, of course, we're all clicking those stupid boxes and none of us are reading them. And so there's this veneer of consent, which is problematic. But then there's this notion that one can consent individually for data that isn't really just about ourselves, right? It's about our families, it's about our communities. These are issues that came up in the context of DNA and genomics, and they're coming up against it again in the context of AI and not being addressed appropriately.
I mean, especially when you consider that the ways in which AI uses data, by design, it's about repurposing that data. You might train an algorithm on one sort of data set, as you know, Facebook have just announced that they're going to delete one of their facial recognition models and they're going to delete one of their data sets and everybody's expected to cheer. But then a bunch of AI observers have said, well, what happens to all of the algorithms that you trained on those data sets, which will then go on to be repurposed for other things? So the connection between data provenance and data use is much more complicated with AI.
And if you're giving lots of different kinds of data, then all kinds of inferences can be made about you where you didn't actually consent to providing that data, but the inference can still be made. So what does consent mean? You're not actually giving consent at the level that your data is being used. And of course, as I said, it's then having implications for others. I think it's just inadequate. It's fascinating to, I was thinking the other day that it's fascinating to me that the bioethical notion of informed individual consent that kind of stabilized in the 1970s has had this enormous impact on everything. I mean, I have been in conversations where people were actually discussing the idea that we could use individual informed consent for geoengineering technologies, which clearly makes no sense, but we don't have any more creativity beyond that. It's like, oh, that works. Especially it fits in the US notion of extreme individualism. Let's go with that for all of the things, all of the time. The other thing I'll just briefly mention is that the National Science Foundation is also creating something called the National Artificial Intelligence Research Resource. And the idea, I think, they don't say this explicitly, but I think the idea is to create alternative sources of data so that it's not all owned by the big tech companies and to create resources for researchers. But they are using all of this interesting language around democratization and equity. And the people who are providing public comments are particular kinds of publics, right? They are not community groups in Detroit. I mean that seriously. It is those communities that are likely to be the most affected by the algorithms that get created because they might be used, for example, to allocate government services, and yet they don't have a voice, don't even know this thing is being created. And so it's interesting how democracy is getting made and reinforced in particular ways that maintains particular power relationships, let's say.
Yeah, well, like with so many things, right? The AI Bill of Rights, GDPR, and whatever Britain comes up with to assert that it is somehow different from Europe, which appears to be the only thing that governments are interested in right now. All of these things, they may be a start. The danger is that policymakers dust off their hands and say, job done, once these things are in place, and hope that individuals are going to exercise their rights and hold the owners of AI responsible, which just means that there's no place to discuss all of the questions that we've been trying to grapple with on this podcast, to do with who do we think is going to benefit from AI? And if it is a gigantic force multiplier for inequality, who's going to stick up for the public interest when these models of rights and consent are shown to be hilariously inadequate? Anyway, we should talk about our guest, should we not?
Yes, I think on that note, the questions you were just asking, our guest offers some really fabulous and unique insights.
So this is Karen Levy. Karen is at Cornell, and she's been doing some fascinating work for the last few years on truckers. This is one of those areas where new technologies are intervening and being deployed in an area with some really interesting class dynamics. Trucking is a particular issue in Britain, I should point out, at the moment, because all of our truckers have left the country.
And not just because they're being surveilled.
Well, indeed, not because of surveillance, because they can have a much nicer life back home in Europe in most cases.
We're also having a trucking shortage.
One of the points that Karen makes in the interview is that truckers, when you say labor shortage to them, they correct you and say, no, it's a wage shortage. If you paid us more, there would be more of us. So Karen, we should point to her forthcoming book, which is called Data Driven. And it's all about the way that technologies are being used to surveil truckers, and in fact being used to automate the management of truckers, and what that means for the workers at the sharp end of these technological deployments. And it was a fascinating conversation, and we think that you will enjoy it.
So dive right in.
So Karen, hello, welcome to the Received Wisdom. You've been doing a range of supremely interesting work at the intersection of tech, surveillance, labor. You've been doing some really lovely detailed work looking in particular at the lives and labors of truckers in the US. Can you just maybe start off by telling us a little bit about who truckers are, what the cultures, the practices are, and why you were interested to find out more about them in the first place?
Yeah, I would love to do that. So I have spent, at this point, a not insubstantial proportion of my life studying truck drivers. I started studying them in 2011, kind of out of nowhere. Like, I didn't have any connection to the industry. I'm from Indiana, which has a lot of truck drivers, but no one in my family was a trucker or anything. But I started looking into trucking kind of on a whim, to be honest. So my background is in sociology and in law, and I was really interested in these moments where we start to think about enforcing rules using technology rather than via fiat or via some other set of incentives or something. And I just happened to hear this story on the radio that made mention of truckers and how they were going to be digitally monitored, which they weren't at that time. So at the time I was in Oregon, I was doing an internship at Intel for the summer. And I thought, like, well, let me just go to like a truck stop and see what it's like to talk to truckers. And it turned out it was incredibly fun, like really, really fun to talk to truck drivers who have a lot to say, right? They have a lot of stories to tell, a lot of wisdom. They don't get to talk to that many people. They're solo a lot of the time. The public opinion of truckers in the United States is not really positive. Some of that has to do with the political organization of the industry. The industry deregulated in the 80s and truckers' wages declined by a lot, and there were a bunch of other factors. But it was really neat to get to talk to these people and get a sense for kind of what their lives were like, which I didn't know anything about, and how it was being affected by technology. So yeah, trucking is an interesting profession because by the numbers and it's sort of objectively, it's what we would consider like a bad job. It's a really dangerous job. There's a trucking economist named Michael Belzer who compares trucking to, he calls it sweatshop. It's a sweatshop on wheels in terms of how long truckers work and how little they're paid for it and how likely they are to be killed or injured on the job. They're away from home for a long time. Work that's gotten harder and less well paid in the last several decades. And yet, if you talk to truckers, there's a really strong occupational culture, a real pride associated with the work. It's really interesting. When I talk to truckers about why they got interested in the profession, for a lot of them, it was autonomy, a sense of freedom, of not being told what to do all the time. It's a kind of blue-collar labor that is relatively unique in terms of the autonomy that workers have in comparison with, you know, working in a factory, or at least it has historically been relatively unique in terms of the fairly minimal oversight that truckers have had on a day-to-day basis.
So if you're a trucker, sort of part of the appeal is some sense in which you are your own boss and you feel a little bit like a small businessman. Another point that you make is that it's overwhelmingly massively male, isn't it?
It's quite male, yeah. I think that it's about 95% male. Proportion of women in the industry is actually growing quite a bit. Racially, it's about 62% white, with fairly large proportions of new immigrant populations. There are often kind of enclaves of immigrant truckers in different cities. And then the median age in trucking is, I think it's 47. So it's kind of an industry in transition demographically, but it's still largely male. And when I say male, it's male and it's like masculine male. One kind of component of the culture historically has been this sense of bodily stamina and masculinity and power that comes from piloting a big rig on the road. That has been kind of a source of power for folks who have felt maybe disempowered in other aspects of life.
And can you tell us a bit, Karen, about what it's like to do the sort of research that you do? You do ethnographic research, which for some of our listeners, they will know what that means. But just tell us a bit about what it means day to day. Is it hanging out in trucks? Is it hanging out with truckers at truck stops? Is it interviews, just snippets of conversation? Are you just sitting there and surveilling them in your own way?
Yeah, it's always interesting to do research on surveillance when you are yourself sort of a surveiller, right? You are also a data collector, which raises some interesting methodological questions. Because I was really interested in how this object, this digital monitoring device, was affecting the industry, I wanted to kind of get a sense of it from lots of different angles. So part of how I did that was, I would say, a broader but less deep engagement with many different actors in the industry. I did go to a lot of truck stops. I talked to a ton of drivers in truck stops. That tended to be a good place to talk to folks because that's where they go when they, as maybe we'll talk about, one of the big issues in trucking is time. They have very, very difficult to navigate rules about how much they can drive. So if they're in the bar, that's a good sign that, you know, they're not getting back on the road anytime soon. And maybe they want to talk. I went to four different firms to talk to managers and fleet safety folks and dispatchers and stuff like that. I talked to regulators and insurance folks. So I would say the work is focused predominantly on the experience of the trucker. And I really care a lot about the labor perspective of what it is to engage with these technologies. But I also wanted to kind of get this other view. I also spent some time talking to law enforcement officers. I was really interested in how their work was also being changed here, how their interactions with truckers were changing.
Tell us a bit about what the technologies in question are. You describe a culture that's quite a well-established culture with proud traditions of its own, and yet you also describe their lives under threat or being disrupted through these technologies. What technologies are you talking about?
Yeah, so the technology I focus in the most concerted way on is something called an electronic logging device, or an ELD. And what that is so truckers are limited by federal regulation in terms of how many hours a week they can drive, which is obviously a safety regulation. They can only drive so many hours per day and per week. And those types of regulations have been in place since the 1930s. But historically, the way that truckers keep track of that time has been just on pencil and paper logs. And it's like a well-known secret, not secret within the industry that you just make stuff up for those because you're not incentivized really to tell the truth. Truckers are almost always paid by the mile. So they're incentivized to like drive as much as they possibly can. And the federal government was concerned that maybe we don't want people breaking the law. Maybe we don't want truckers driving when they're really tired. And so the way they chose to respond to that problem was by requiring all truckers in the United States, long haul truckers, to install these logging devices. And what those are is they're like a little box that's hardwired to the truck that basically just keeps track of where the truck is and when it's driving so that you can infer how long the driver has been on the road. And then those are subject to inspection by law enforcement officers or when truckers go through a weigh station or something. So that was kind of the core technology. So these were mandated in 2017. There was a long discussion leading up to that about when they would be mandated and what that would look like. But one of the things that I discovered is that the electronic logging device is not only an electronic logging device. It actually becomes this really convenient way for companies to also add more monitoring capabilities to keep track of their drivers.
One question I had that is related to the monitoring device, but maybe related to these other questions, is first of all, who's doing the development of the technology? And also then my understanding is, and maybe this is developed over time, is that there are all of these assumptions embedded into the technology about what is appropriate sleep patterns, when should a trucker sleep, what are those assumptions based on, and how does it then influence the monitoring and really the disciplining of the trucker?
Yeah, that's a great question. The easy answer, and I think the answer that many folks in the industry would give, is that all this is really doing is enforcing the rules that were already there. The electronic logging device didn't change the hours of service rules. So I think it's easy to say this is the same thing we were doing. We already agreed that these rules were valid. They've been challenged in court and upheld. Don't we want people to follow the rules? But the other way to look at it is that maybe we don't actually want people to always follow the rules. And there are certainly really significant downsides to having truckers break these rules, which is something I hope we'll get to talk about, both for companies and for truckers themselves. The way the industry functions does not depend on them following these rules all the time. They need to break these rules in order to move goods at the speed that their employers expect from them. They need to break these rules often to get to like safe places to park. Like if you're driving, you know, from Michigan to Florida, you may think that's going to take 20 hours, however long that takes. But it might not take exactly 20 hours, right? Like we all know there's a lot of contingencies on the road. So if you don't build flexibility into the system, I think that's the biggest assumption, right? Is that the plans are the plans and there's not going to be any need for this flexibility.
So are the people developing the technology, are they justifying their innovations, not just in terms of efficiencies for the companies running the trucks, but also for the truck drivers in a sort of a, this is there to protect you, it's there so that people can't take advantage, so that you get the sleep that you need to stay safe and all the rest of that?
Yeah, 100%. The rhetoric around it is very much focused on empowerment. So safety first and foremost, and that's not wrong. There are real problems with overwork and fatigue in the industry, and there are real problems with competition. Some truckers actually really like these devices because they would say, I want to follow the rules, but I'm competing against guys who don't follow the rules. And if we all have to use the same device, then that actually helps me have a more healthy life and also make a living. It's far from clear cut, but certainly the rhetoric is, this is in place to protect you. This is going to make your life easier. You're not going to have to do all this paperwork. This is good for everyone and good for the public. So public safety organizations came out in favor of these too. About 4,000 people a year die in the United States in truck accidents. They're really expensive. They're really deadly. There are good reasons to want the roads to be safer.
It's like the argument about speed cameras here in Britain, where we have many more speed cameras than you do over there in the States. And speed cameras should be a relatively uncontroversial technology, right? Because we know that there are speed limits. We know why speed limits exist. But as soon as you put an automated enforcement mechanism in there, the example in France, where during the Gilets Jaunes protest, more than half of all of France's speed cameras were destroyed. So it shows you how much the scale of antipathy towards a technology that should be at one level justified in terms of efficiency, safety, it's just there to enforce the rules that we've already got. And yet it becomes so controversial. In the case of truckers, is it just because truckers are a bunch of recalcitrant, grumpy, unruly libertarians?
No, I wouldn't say that they're a group of recalcitrant, grumpy libertarians. Obviously, there's a lot of variability within the profession. But yeah, by and large, it's an industry where part of the occupational culture is not necessarily to have like a lot of faith in law enforcement. Truckers hop from company to company with astonishing regularity. The turnover rate in trucking is 100% a year. Like every trucker on average leaves his job every year. So truckers like do not broach restrictions on their movement very much. And one of the chapters of the book that I'm working on is all about many, many resistance strategies that truckers use, which was really fun to learn about. But that's not it. What it is that they need to make a living. This is a job. It's a very difficult job. It's a job where wages have declined a hugely significant amount in the last few decades. For truckers to put food on the table requires this certain amount of flexibility, and their companies require that flexibility. Some truckers have been coerced to break these rules quite regularly. So we like mandate competing things from them. We say like, be safe, follow the rules, but also like, I want my Amazon delivery, so please bring it to me. It's not clear how they're supposed to do both of those things at the same time.
You are getting at something I think that's really interesting. And of course, it's something that sociologists have talked about a lot, which is the role of informal practices and informality and flexibility to make systems work. There needs to be some informality, and that actually mitigates against the march of technology and AI to essentially technologically enforce rules. So I'm wondering, one aspect of this is, are truckers able to resist these new technologies? How do those forms of resistance compare to previous forms of resistance? Is there a narrowing scope of that resistance, or is it kind of the same?
There's a lot of aspects of this project that I've really enjoyed, but probably my favorite has been uncovering these resistance strategies, both because it was kind of methodologically challenging and because they're just so creative. There's so many interesting things that truckers do. But in response to your question, I think I went into this thinking what resistance is this very bottom-up practice where truckers are going to be trying to basically like cheat in the way that they did on their logbooks. They're going to try and like eke out some extra driving time. And that is definitely still a component of it. These things are supposed to be tamper-proof, but they're not totally tamper-proof. And there are all kinds of various practices you can use to exploit some of the limitations of the device. Or some truckers just brute force it, like they'll just smash the thing with a hammer. There's a whole variety of things that truckers will do. But actually, I think some of the more interesting practices are not actually oriented toward helping them not record their drive time. They're actually these really interesting kind of expressive or identity affirming acts. So like one of my favorite ones, there's a YouTube video that I talk about in the book of this trucker named Scooby Tulsa. That's obviously not his real name, right? But that's his handle. And one of the things he does in this video, he's showing how he takes his electronic logging device and it runs on like a Windows XP backend. And he's showing how you can press this certain sequence of keys in order to get to the Windows interface. And from that, he shows how the trucker can use that to play computer solitaire. His voice is really derisive when he talks about this. He uses all these curse words and talks about his company in not glamorous terms. And then at the end of the day, all he wants to do is play solitaire. He's not really changing the system at all. He's not eking out extra drive time. He's just like sticking it to the man by playing solitaire. And I feel like that's actually really meaningful. That's a really identity affirming practice. But there's an interesting debate among resistance scholars about, should we celebrate those types of moves, or should we think of them as maybe even helping to ossify systems of exploitation? And I think it's the former, right? I think there's something really important about resistance as identity formation, not just resistance as actually taking a system down. But, you know, I think the other aspect of it that's really interesting is that to the extent truckers are resisting in order to make more money under the current system, that's not necessarily good either. Some people call this self-sweating, right? Like they're basically like exploiting themselves, or they're allowing themselves to be exploited further because of the pay conditions in the industry. And it's dangerous both for them and for us next to them on the road.
There must be also sort of more forceful ways in which truckers assert their own expertise and try to push back at the designs that are being imposed upon them. In a paper from a few years ago, you talk about how the trucker's saying, I can't drive because there's a storm. And the chap back at base is saying, well, I can see on this app that there isn't. And the trucker, historically, I guess, would have been able to be the sole judge of whether it was safe and appropriate to drive. So how do those sorts of arguments play out?
One of the things I'm really interested in is the way that information and expertise gets shifted around by these systems, right? So to your point, it used to be the case that truckers had what sometimes gets called a ship captain model. The trucker was in really the only position to make judgments about the safety of the road or how he felt in his body or things like that. Before cell phones, he would get in touch with the dispatcher when he felt like it from a payphone at the truck stop. A ton of autonomy, a ton of really exclusive knowledge. And that, of course, has changed 100%. Now, there's real-time visibility from the back office into where the trucker is. There's predictive technology to assess even before it happens whether the trucker is going to violate hours or make a delivery on time, things like that. Even more than that, I think that type of kind of localized knowledge is less important than it used to be, because now the dispatcher can say, well, I see that the weather where you are is not that bad. Or maybe more importantly, I see that actually all the other drivers that I am also simultaneously supervising are somehow able to like make passage on this road that you can't. So that's like a very different form of knowledge, this comparative, aggregated kind of knowledge that really changes the degree to which a trucker has that autonomy to make those decisions. There's a lot of pushback there, to be honest, truckers are pretty limited in what they can do. And part of the turnover in the industry, I think, is often comes about by these exchanges or feeling kind of disrespected by dispatch.
The clash between the ideal of the job being the captain of your ship or the master of your own destiny, and then the reality, which is that actually you're being told what to do either by a machine or by somebody back at base who is armed with all sorts of machines that trump your knowledge.
Yeah, I think that hits drivers differently based on who they are. I mean, a lot of the drivers I talked to had been driving, I think one person had been driving for 47 years, had millions of safe miles under his belt. As the vanguard of the old guys die off or retire, more and more truckers are 18, just getting their CDL. They've maybe been driving a truck for 6 weeks, and they've not known a system other than the one we have now. There's, I think, less active resistance, or at least resistance looks different for those drivers than it does for the older guys.
Can you say a bit, Karen, about what the implications might be for how we think about other practices that are sort of increasingly being labeled gig economy practices, where it's less about a group of accredited and experienced experts who are finding technology impacting upon their job, and more about technology enabling new classes of labor where people with very little heritage and tradition are finding that here in London, it's all about food delivery.
I've been thinking about that a lot lately, actually. You know, in trucking specifically, devaluing the knowledge of folks who've been driving for a long time actually like makes us all much less safe. You would much rather drive next to the guy who's been on the road for 47 years and doesn't like the computer than an 18-year-old who's been driving for 6 weeks. Statistically, those drivers are much, much, much less safe, unsurprisingly. That's a policy choice to say like, oh, no, we're just going to kind of make these folks expendable and interchangeable. And then the other aspect of it is that one of the ways that trucking companies have dealt with what they call a labor shortage, what truckers call a wage shortage in trucking, is not to actually raise wages. Instead, what they do is they reach out to these new demographics. And sometimes that can be good because it diversifies the industry. But sometimes these are statistically less safe demographics. The move to 18-year-olds, for example, it used to be, or in many places, I think it might still be 21, was the minimum age to get a CDL. And that's been lowered because they just needed new meat. They needed new people to do this. There have been interesting conversations at different state levels about removing, you know, there's drug testing often in trucking. And that also cuts out a big possible sector of labor. What it points out is it's treating labor like any other asset. You just cycle in new folks instead of changing conditions for the folks who are there, right, who have that expertise.
Is there any capacity for organized response to some of these changes, especially the technological ones?
Yeah, it's interesting. There have been some protests, actually. So in the 70s, there were actually pretty successful trucker protests in the United States, largely around fuel costs. So there were some really big and sometimes quite violent stoppages, basically. But the more recent stuff has not been as successful. There have been some demonstrations. They call it a slow roll, where trucks will all drive at the minimum highway speed, which I think is 45 miles an hour, to block a highway. So they did this in Indianapolis a few years ago to protest this technology. And they were hoping, I think, it would be like a huge success. Their hashtag, it's really offensive, but their hashtag was Black Smoke Matters. But I think ultimately they ended up getting a few dozen folks. And they've tried this in a few different places. That sort of collective action, I think, has been less successful. It's hard for me to say why. Certainly there are Facebook groups where truckers complain about this stuff and try to organize these things. But I would be really surprised if some mass movement happens in the next few years. It would be logistically difficult to organize. And culturally, I'm not really sure that these drivers are going to kind of rise up collectively.
Can I mention another really interesting analog that in sort of reading some of your stuff, I couldn't help but think about? Jack talked about the gig economy and food delivery, and obviously your work has implications across AI. But I don't know if you knew about this, but in the winter of 2020, a number of farmers in India started to protest. And the reason that they were protesting was because the government was trying to institute all of these rules, essentially trying to kind of standardize agricultural prices across the country and limit the ability of individual farmers to set their own food prices. And that led to strikes and then significant protests in Delhi. As I was reading your stuff, I was thinking about this as a broader story, actually, about labor and capital. From the perspective of the government, this is about modernization. It's about efficiencies. It's also about protections and about, in the Indian context, it's also about making formal, informal, you know, more informal practices and informal economies. But I can't help but think about, in terms of this argument in favor of legibility and protection.
I can definitely see the parallel. I mean, I'm curious in the farmer context that this has come up. One interesting question that has emerged a little bit recently is there some, I don't know if truckers would call it this, but is there like some emancipatory potential or some advocacy potential in the data itself that these systems gather? I think most truckers are not thinking about that, right? But some truckers have started to ask those questions, and some organizations have started to do this. Like, if you're gathering data about where truckers are, you are also sort of implicitly gathering data about what their work is like, which has been very easy to ignore certain aspects of their work, especially their unpaid work, which much of their day is unpaid. But now we have all this hard data about how much time, for example, truckers spend waiting to be loaded and unloaded at a shipping terminal. So this is called detention time in the industry. And truckers will tell you it's by far the biggest fatigue driver in the industry, is that they don't get paid for the time that they sit there for 4 hours waiting to be unloaded. It's like at the airport, when you get to the airport and you like taxi around, you can't just sleep during that time if you're piloting the truck. But they're not getting paid for it either. And that eats into their work time. So this is part of why they feel like they need to then catch up. And now we have all this information on exactly where truckers are being detained for longer. Now, it's not illegal for shippers to do that. They can do that. And there are obviously power dynamics between trucking companies and shippers that are quite variable about, can you limit the amount of detention time that drivers face? But there's one group that has kind of amassed a bunch of driver data from these logging devices and has submitted a report to the FMCSA, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, trying to kind of articulate what are the safety costs of detention time. Should we start thinking about that as an object of regulation, as a way to actually deal with this fatigue problem? Will that happen? I'm not sure. But it is kind of what you're referring to, I think, this effort to say like, okay, well, we're going to be surveilled. So like, how could we use this data for our own purposes or to advocate for ourselves?
That's really interesting. You've written more recently about trucks as potential autonomous vehicles. And I was really taken by a line actually from one of your earlier papers where you were talking about one driver's response to the form of a very simple technological form of surveillance, which is just to say, well, if you don't trust me, why not just put a robot in the truck, right? And this was before people were talking about putting robots in trucks. And now there are a number of companies who have, in particular, recognizing that a self-driving universal vehicle is far harder than they were ready to admit at first, suppose that actually trucking is a relatively easy domain to organize, right? Predictable roads. On the whole, it's keeping thing in a straight line for 90% of the time. And if you've got a human there to deal with the complicated things, then that's sort of brilliant. What is the arrival of the possibility for a more profound form of AI in doing the driving itself? What does that mean for trucking and for truckers, do you think?
So, yeah, I will admit to you that in 2011, when I started working on trucking and technology, nobody was really thinking about autonomous trucks, or somebody was thinking about it, but it wasn't like part of the kind of national conversation. And over time, when I would tell people I studied trucking and technology, they would immediately assume that what I meant was autonomous vehicles. And I got a little nervous. Were these systems all going to go by the wayside? Because suddenly, like, there would be no truckers. So I started to do some more research on autonomous trucking because it was clear that that was becoming part of the narrative. What I was thinking, I think, before was quite naive. It's certainly not the case that autonomy just comes in and replaces labor surveillance. In fact, I think what we see happening is there are these visions of trucking as being this kind of prime site for automation for a variety of technical reasons and social reasons, and the fact that the industry like struggles, right, with all of these labor issues. And yet we've seen autonomous trucking startups fold and fold and fold, and companies having a hard time doing, like, they've tried all kinds of different models of organizing the work, and it's just really difficult. The actual way that AI, I think, is being felt in trucking now is not, oh, well, we're out of a job, there are no truckers anymore, but instead this much more like invasive form of technology. Often what this consists of is, because we know that truckers are liable to be fatigued, the way we have chosen to deal with that is through really intensive like biometric monitoring. So some of this is through wearables. So there's a whole bunch of really interesting wearables on the market now that will monitor a driver's brain waves or a driver's heartbeat or a driver's eyelid flutter or a driver's head movement. Some of them are camera systems and some are wearable. And we'll do all of these things. The driver's still very much in the cab, right? But he's now in the cab, sort of being surrounded by or touched by all of these AI-driven systems. It's not that they're being kicked out by a robot. It's that they're being sort of hybridized in a way.
The implications for that, those are so profound. The idea that robots aren't putting humans out of work, right? They're transforming the nature of work and maybe displacing work to other places or to other forms. But it appears to be such a sort of transparent enactment of power, and it's not what was being promised, which is that you take out the driver with all of his flaws and you plop in a flawless computer, save a bunch of money, make everybody safer, make everybody happier, solve the labor shortage, job done.
You know, certainly the popular narrative about robots taking our jobs has focused largely on like the quantity of jobs, like who's going to be unemployed, which is, of course, the super important, like, I'm glad we're talking about that. Those are important things for us to talk about, especially when it comes to low-wage labor. But it's not the only concern. These truckers still have jobs, but the nature of their jobs has changed a lot. The quality of their jobs has changed a lot. I think one thing that's really important to recognize is that the reason drivers are so fatigued, that's about like the political organization of the industry. If we paid drivers for the time they work rather than the time they drive, we would disincentivize overwork. They would be able to take the breaks they need. They would be able to inspect their trucks when they need to. They would not be like on the edge of falling asleep all the time, right? And rather than ameliorate it through labor law, so truckers are exempt from fair labor standards, I should mention. They don't get overtime pay. They don't get the kinds of protections that other folks get under the Fair Labor Standards Act. So instead of dealing with it that way, what we do is we do this band-aid where we like sometimes shock a driver back into alertness when his eyelids start to flutter, right? Or we flash lights in his eyes or we call his boss or something. That's like a really interesting choice that we've made, I think, to use technology, you know, in this kind of band-aid-y way. Rather than attack the root, we attack the symptoms.
It makes me think about both the psychological implications as well as the political implications in terms of alienation from previous technologies and in other contexts. Things like installing metal detectors in schools, for example, lead students to feel constantly surveilled, to increase their levels of anxiety, to remove their individuality in ways that are deeply problematic, certainly for kids. And I'm wondering if either through your ethnographic work or if you know of other work that looks at what the implications are for how this affects truckers.
Yeah, it's a really good question. There's some folks who've done, the researchers are named Anne Belay and Mona Chattel, and they've done really interesting work on trucker mental health, largely finding similar types of things as what you're talking about. Actually, I always like to shout out Anne Belay's work. She has this wonderful book called Semi-Queer that's about gay and trans truck drivers and the particular burden that these technologies place on them. It's a wonderful book and everybody should go read it because these are intensely privacy invasive technologies. Putting a camera in the cab has a very different effect on a transgender truck driver who may be unsafe going into a truck stop than a white man truck driver, that, you know, cis male truck driver. So there's that component of it. This doesn't hit everybody equally. But I also think you're right more broadly that when a lot of the sense of autonomy that people have derives from their occupation, derives from the culture, and it's a proud one, right? This is what compensates for the fact that they're away from their families and what compensates for the fact that they don't actually get paid all that much and what compensates for the fact that it has the 8th highest rate of occupational fatalities in the United States. And when you attack those things by shining a camera in your face because I don't trust you, or hooking you up to some hat that's reading your brainwaves all the time to make sure that you're not tired, even though you can tell me if you're tired, but I'm going to monitor it because I don't really believe you. Of course, that is going to have a cumulative effect on the pride that folks feel.
And at the same time, you know, the narrative of the autonomous vehicle is all about how, oh, well, it'll be brilliant because we can free you up as the driver rather than you doing all this drudge work on the open road. You will be able to either be sitting in the back of the cab, educating yourself, or you'll be able to do higher skilled forms of labor involving logistics and managerial things in the cabins.
That duality, like you put your finger on it very nicely, actually, this rhetoric of freedom versus the reality of this sort of forced hybridization between man and machine is really stark. The other, I think, really interesting duality is just between the idea of displacement. You are not here anymore, right? Like you don't have a job. You're not in the cab. that's a narrative, but that's also stands in a really different juxtaposition to what is actually happening, which is like, no, you're still here. It's just like, we have joined you with this machine that you can't escape and is invading in this very intimate way. It's like this weird kind of gloss on the cyborg.
We should probably wrap up, but just, I'm curious about your methodological approach and in particular, the extent to which you are bringing your findings back to the folks that you've connected with, what role they play. Because I know with ethnographic work, often that's a question. And so I'm wondering where they figure in terms of as you've been doing the work and coming to conclusions and writing the book, do they play a continuing role? And also in shaping the kinds of recommendations that you have on how to manage these issues.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's a great set of questions I could talk for a whole other hour about. I'll say only that one of the interesting things has been thinking about both how to share and how not to share. So some of the work that I've done, I don't actually know how this happened, but at some point, some trucking companies, they told their friend trucking companies or something, trucking carriers, wanted to talk about these systems. And they were really interested, particularly in the resistance strategy stuff. Like, how is it the truckers are trying to get around things? I love talking about my work. I don't want to narc on these drivers, right? Like, I don't want to. So there's actually a lot that I didn't report in the book. I took care to only report resistance strategies that were kind of well known, right, or that had been documented online, or where I didn't feel like I was giving anybody's secrets away, or I would like attenuate things. To your other question, you're definitely right. One feature of a lot of ethnographic work that I think is really generative is having this continued conversation with respondents. I don't have long-term relationships with my respondents in the way that some hardcore ethnographers do, where they go back to the same block or the same company repeatedly. I kind of traded off these repeated interactions for broader interactions, right? Talk to more people rather than a few people for longer. You know, there's upsides and downsides to that. But one downside is not being able to go back and talk to them as much about the findings. That said, like, I still have a pretty active relationship with the community. A few years ago, I got to sit on a trucker call-in show on, I don't know if you ever listened to Road Dog Trucking Radio on Sirius XM, channel 146. It's a great call-in show. And that was super fun to like talk about my work and then like talk to drivers who called in and talk about their own experiences. So that's been fun. I've talked to some policymakers, you know, at the regulator about the findings, although again, they're kind of aware of what these problems are. I just think it's really important probably for all of us who are doing work on tech or work on labor to do like public engagement, right? To do a lot of writing for the public.
So just finally, Karen, tell us, so you have a book coming out. When can we expect it?
The finish line is so close. It's being published by Princeton University Press. It's called Data Driven, get it? Truckers in the New Workplace Surveillance. And I think we are estimating that it should be out in the winter 2022 catalog. So hopefully very soon. And the book covers everything we talked about today, kind of like tries to trace the history of this kind of trucking technology object, this electronic logging device, as kind of a political object and a cultural object, and tries to take all these sort of different passes at it from different perspectives to get at the complexity of the enforcement technology. And then also gets into some of the questions about autonomy and features at the end.
I, for one, and I know lots of others, look forward to it hugely.
Well, thank you so much, Karen. This has been amazing and really interesting in all sorts of ways. And I'm sure our listeners will agree.
Well, this was really fun for me. Thank you so much for having me.
We gather our hands and hope for the best, but only a fool would let the world just spin.
The Received Wisdom podcast is edited by Edward Wysonin and produced with help from the Shapiro Design Lab at the University of Michigan. We would love it if you would subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platforms. You can also find all the recordings, transcripts, and links to the books, articles, and other stuff we discuss in this episode at our website, thereceivedwisdom.org. That's thereceivedwisdom, one word, .org. Talk to you soon.